The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, naturopathic physician and professional herbalist, here with another edition where we take you on through fabulous information on health, wellness, and issues in alternative medicine today. And so today we have a fabulous guest. We have David Winston. He is a registered herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild and ethnobotanist who's practiced Cherokee, Chinese, and Western medicine since 1969. Founding member of the American Herbalist Guild, an internationally known lecturer on the topic of herbal medicine, president of Herbalist and Alchemist, a wonderful phytotherapy company that makes over 300 herbal products. And he's the author of Herbal Therapeutics and Saw Palmetto, for both men and women, and co-author of Herbal Therapy and Supplements. And this book today, which we're going to be talking about, which is called Adaptogens, Herbs for Strength, Stamina, and Stress Relief, which he worked with Stephen Mames, and it's published by Healing Arts Press. Rochester, Vermont website is healingartspress.com, and we're really excited to have David on the program. Let me just give a little background to what we're going to talk about before we introduce David. In the back of his book, he says, we all deal with stress every day, and every day our bodies strive to adapt and stay balanced and healthy. In this book, Adaptogens, the authors provide a comprehensive look into adaptogens, which are non-toxic herbs like ginseng, eleuthero, and others that produce a defensive response to stress in our bodies. These rejuvenating herbs and tonics help the body adapt to the many influences it encounters. They increase stamina and counter the normal effects of aging and are becoming important tools in all types of preventive and anti-aging medicine, as well as treating the chronic syndromes of our times, including chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and many other maladies. So without further ado, let's bring on David Winston. David, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, it's great to have you on the show again.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here. It's been a long time, and I've been looking forward to it.
Tell us a little bit about your background, Dave, and how you ended up writing a great book like this.
Well, two different stories, actually. So basically, back in the late 1960s, I always tell people, all my friends were interested in one herb, and I was interested in all the other ones. And I started studying herbal medicine, and what for me originally was an avocation, meaning something I fell in love with, the idea that you could use plants for medicine, eventually became my vocation, and I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to be trained in three different systems of herbal medicine. And as you know, as somebody who's been doing this for a very long time, you know, when I first started doing this, people would say to me, well, what do you do? And I'd say, well, I'm an herbalist. And they'd look at me like I had just told them I was visiting from another planet. They would look at me and scratch their head and think, poor misguided youth, why would I be wasting my time with something? That would be like, you know, in this day and age saying, what are you studying? And I'm studying how to light the old, you know, the gas lamps outside, you know, something that's been extinct for a very long time. And but fortunately for me, because I loved it, I did it, and it was my passion, and, you know, here we are 43 years later, and there is a tremendous interest and demand, and there are relatively few people who have the sort of cross-cultural background that I have, so I'm very fortunate that not only do I get to travel and teach all over the United States, Canada, Europe, about herbal medicine at universities, medical schools, symposia, write books, have my own school, and you know, so it's wonderful that I've got to really spend my life and hopefully continue for many, many years doing what I love to do. As for the book, it's kind of a funny story. The co-author, Stephen Mames, had called me up out of nowhere. I didn't know him, and in fact did not actually meet him in person until after the book was published, although we spoke on the phone many times. He was thinking of doing a pamphlet on adaptogens and wanted to know if he could use an article that I had written, a fairly extensive article, in his pamphlet. And I said, well, no, not really. I mean, it's copyrighted material. But I said, you know what? There really isn't a good book on adaptogens.
Uh-huh.
I said, why don't we write one? And that's how it came about. And we wrote the book, and it's been very successful.
Certainly is. And I use it in my coursework teaching here at the University of Bridgeport, and particularly in a class that I'm teaching actually right now, which is on geriatrics, but the more focus is not conventional geriatrics, but it's, I call it healthy aging, because
mm-hmm.
it's not really anti-aging, because, you know, you can't be anti-aging, it's inevitable. So you're going to get old, but you might as well arrive in those latter years in a comfortable car, so to speak, instead of a beat-up jalopy, if you know what I mean.
I absolutely do. And the beauty of it is that adaptogens can really, I mean, there is good evidence. You know, a lot of times people say, well, you know, the problem with herbs is there's just not much evidence. Well, the reality is there actually, for many things, there's a dramatic amount, a tremendous amount of good data showing that these things work. The problem is very little of it is published in American journals because this type of research generally is not done in the United States. So you're going to find it many times in foreign languages, although many times first world countries like Japan or France or Germany, as well as countries like India and China, that are doing a tremendous amount of plant-based research. And the sort of foremost researchers in the world of adaptogens are mostly in Germany. They used to be in Russia.
Right.
And I'll have to say that the old Soviet Union, when you saw that research, you had to take it with a fairly large meteorite of salt because the studies usually had no controls, and they were a little iffy. But when you look at German research, you're generally looking at top-quality research, and you have people like Wagner, who is, you know, considered by some to be, you know, one of the all-time great researchers in the field of botanical medicine, and certainly in adaptogens. And then you have another researcher named Panossian, and these gentlemen are doing amazing research. And some of the most recent research on adaptogens is actually rather astounding, because not only does it show that they work, but it's showing that they're working by mechanisms beyond what we thought that they did.
Huh. Well, let's get into that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, let's put one foot in front of the other and just define for the audience an adaptogen. I know it's tough to pin down, but why don't you give us a little history, because I know these things were called chi tonics, rasayanas, restorative,
mm-hmm.
fountains of youth, elixirs, panaceas, all kinds of things.
Well, you know, it's funny, because in one sense, the driving motivation for me in writing this book, not just that there wasn't a book on adaptogens, but in the herbal community, one of the problems is there's often a lack of standardization, not in the sense of product. I'm not a huge fan of that in many cases, but in the sense of terminology. And one of the things that I was seeing more and more was the term adaptogen being used increasingly loosely. And so I saw articles saying that cranberries were an adaptogen and you know, green tea was an adaptogen. And by absolute definition, they are not. So there actually is a very distinct definition of an adaptogen, which unfortunately many people are unaware of. So what is an adaptogen? First off, an adaptogen is a plant-based substance that allows the body to adapt to stress situations. So that could be either psychological stress, physiological stress, temperature, any type of stressor. So these things allow you to adapt more effectively to stress. Number one, they are non-toxic in normal therapeutic doses. Number two, they are not stimulants. So unlike green tea, which acts as a stimulant, Adaptogens have very little effect on somebody who's very healthy, and they have an increasingly more dramatic effect in an organism that is disordered. So the sicker somebody is, the more adaptogens tend to do what they do. And so the differentiation from a stimulant is a stimulant will stimulate somebody who's healthy or unhealthy. So there is a significant difference there. And they work, we originally believed that they worked through two master control systems in the body. One is called the HPA axis, or hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and this is sort of the interface between the hypothalamus and the brain and all of the endocrine system, most of the nervous system, and most of the immune system. And this other system called the SAS, the sympathoadrenal system, which is basically what triggers fight or flight. So you can think of the HPA axis as dealing with things like chronic stress, whereas the SAS more deals with acute stress. So the original definition was that those several factors, non-toxic, plant-based substance that is non-toxic, that has relatively little effect in a healthy organism, but has a greater effect in an organism that is disordered or unhealthy, and that it works through the HPA axis and SAS.
So these plants really, they're no way related. They're on every continent and culture has their own representative of these things, and they're not even defined by their phytochemistry. They have they have very unique chemistries. So, but what defines them is those particular qualities or attributes or effects on the body, I would assume.
Yeah, and what's really interesting, as I said, with the newest research is suggesting, actually it's more than suggesting, it's showing that these are working on the HPA axis and SAS, which they do, by the way. They are also working on a cellular level. Mm. And what they are doing is they are basically helping to prevent downregulation of mitochondrial function. And the mitochondria you can think of as the engines in our cells. And what happens is that when we're under chronic stress, there are certain compounds that are secreted, things like cortisol, but also things like nitric oxide and things like that. And these things basically downregulate the cellular machinery that helps to run our cells. And what they have found is that there are these compounds called chaperone molecules and things like heat shock proteins and forkhead proteins and things like that. And they found that adaptogens basically trigger these things. So in a sense, they almost act like a little bit of a vaccination for stress. So they stimulate these proteins that are triggered during stress that basically prevent the sort of shutdown of mitochondrial function, which then explains one of the reasons that adaptogens are so effective for treating conditions like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, where that is one of the underlying problems.
So it seems to affect these powerhouses in ways that we never really understood.
Absolutely. And you know what's one of the, Eugene, it is really funny because I do so much research and I'm always working on new projects and everything, and I'm always looking for interesting articles, and what I've been finding is the amount of research that is coming out that shows that the whole idea of holism, and of course you and I, you know, being a naturopathic physician and herbalist, and myself as a clinical herbalist, you know, we've always subscribed to the idea that, you know, we have to look at the whole body, not just one system. And I think we've probably both always looked at the idea, for instance, in Chinese medicine, that you have to really go beyond just the individual organism, but the environment and the family and all these things. There is so much research coming out, including this research on adaptogens, that shows that literally everything is connected to everything, whether new research on probiotics relieving anxiety, or oral use of probiotics for acne, or things like adaptogens affecting the mitochondrial function in the cells. And what it is showing is increasingly that the ideas that are part of Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, complementary alternative medicine, Yunani, Tib, Middle Eastern medicine, is these ideas that you have to treat the whole person are absolutely correct.
I mean, and it seems like the adaptogens function on on all those levels, they have specific effects on mental and cognitive aspects,
mm-hmm.
physiological aspects, and even higher aspects, I guess, certainly. Let's talk a little bit about some of these adaptogens specifically, and I know, unfortunately, we only have about 40 more minutes of the show, but let's talk about, like, the great adaptogens of different cultures. I know
mm-hmm.
you practice kind of cultural medicine in the Cherokee Native American tradition, in your tradition, but then you also have some certainly training in the eclectic tradition and Chinese tradition, and then I'm sure you're schooled and learned in Ayurvedic medicine and tradition. So every tradition, you know, you go to different places of the world. Like, I'm going to Jamaica with my students. I have about a dozen students on my annual sojourn to the West Indies to study with the Maroons and Rasta healers, and they have their adaptogens down.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ones that they claim is an adaptogen, they call strong back.
Strong back, yes.
Which is Morak. It's basically the root of the noni.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Morinda species, and it's interesting how they use it for so many different maladies, and it seems to have this kind of normalizing effect. So tell us a little bit about the great adaptogens, probably the more well-researched ones that the listeners could get hold of and start using.
Well, if we wanted to do it from a sort of culture-by-culture perspective, which is an interesting way of looking at it,
yeah.
We could do that.
Sure.
Probably the system of medicine that has the most well-developed concept of adaptogens, and understand that even in these other cultures, they had ideas about tonics. So in Chinese medicine, you have qi tonics and blood tonics and yin tonics and kidney yang tonics. Some of them are some of those are adaptogens, but not all of them are adaptogens. And so you have to, again, look at whether it meets the actual criteria. So a tonic may not be an adaptogen, but certainly all adaptogens would fit the concept of a tonic or
okay.
something you could take on a regular basis as to sort of nourish and strengthen the organism. But one of the things I want the listeners to understand is that you do not want to assume that all adaptogens are created equal. And so one of the beauties is learning about adaptogens, and it's one of the things that I do in the book, is that we have an adaptogen materia medica, and we look at adaptogens one by one, and we explain what they do and how they work, the energetics of the herb, whether they are heating or cooling or stimulating or calming. So somebody who is overstimulated would not want to take a more stimulating adaptogen. Somebody who is, who is very lethargic and tired probably would want more of a stimulating adaptogen rather than one of the more calming adaptogens.
So even though they have a balancing effect, they still have kind of characteristics of them,
yes,
or natures of themselves.
I would think of them as each has a personality.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you really want to understand the personality of the plant so you can determine which adaptogen, if any. I wouldn't say that everybody needs adaptogens. I would just say almost everybody needs adaptogens. You would want to find out which one or ones are best for you. So, for instance, if we look at Chinese medicine, which, as I said, probably the 3/4 of the adaptogens that we know are definitely adaptogens come out of Chinese medicine, and the best known adaptogen in the world would be Panax ginseng, also known as Chinese ginseng or Asian ginseng. And here we have a plant that has been used for literally thousands of years, and there's a tremendous mythos around ginseng. And I remember years ago I was teaching. Oh, goodness gracious, this is probably 35 years ago. I was teaching someplace, and this gentleman comes up to me, and he says, "I hear you're an herbalist." And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, I take herbs." And so, okay, I knew the game by that point. "Oh, what do you take?" And he goes, "I take ginseng." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Why do you take it?" And he says, "It's good for your nature." And I looked at him, I said, "You're what?" And he said, "Yeah, nature," with a kind of a wink-wink, and it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I would have said at that point, well, ginseng is a remarkable plant. Of course, it had this history and stories about it being used for enhancing libido and erectile function in men and things like that, and I would have told you 35 years ago, I would have said, well, not really. I think it's an adaptogen. So if you're exhausted, depleted, obviously sexual functioning is going to be affected by that, and it would have an effect, but it would be sort of secondary, not as a primary activity. Well, there's multiple studies that have been done out of Korea, and they do pretty good research in Korea as well, and it shows that the old wives' tale of ginseng, and who would know better than the old wives, they were right. Ginseng, it turns out, actually has benefits for things like erectile dysfunction. And so, you know, ginseng is this remarkable plant. It's been shown to lower blood sugar levels. It enhances endocrine function, immune function, and in fact, in the immune system, it's what's known as an immune apoteric, meaning it normalizes immune function. So you could give ginseng, and not just Chinese ginseng or Asian ginseng, but even American ginseng, which is a different plant, but related. You could give that to somebody who has allergies, and it will help to the immune system to re-regulate itself so that it's not so overactive. You could give it to somebody with an immune depletion condition, whether it be chronic Lyme's disease, chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome, you know, whatever, and it will help nourish and strengthen the immune system. Or you can give it to somebody with an autoimmune disease, which is more interesting because there you have a condition where you, in most cases, have a prematurely aged immune system, and one aspect of it is hyper-functioning or over-functioning. Right. And in every single one of those cases, assuming that it's the appropriate herb for that person, it will help to re-regulate the immune system. And I had someone ask me one time, well, how does it know which one to do? And it doesn't know what to do. What it's doing is strengthening and nourishing the immune system so that it can regain its self-regulatory capacity, which is what a normal, healthy immune system can do.
Right. Fascinating. And different types of ginseng, certainly, or let's put it this way, different manufacturers of ginseng. I mean, you can go to the gas station, stop off, you know, on your way gassing up on a late night sojourn and pick up a little tube of ginseng in the gas station, or certainly you can get a better product. Tell us a little bit about what's on the market this day and age.
Well, you know, honestly, I'm not even entirely sure. I mean, there are probably hundreds of ginseng products on the market, in the marketplace. And, you know, ginseng, good quality ginseng is not inexpensive. So if you have a product that's really inexpensive, it either probably has very little ginseng in it, or it may not actually even be ginseng at all. I know Herbalgram, which is a wonderful publication that anybody's interested in herbal medicine should be aware of and should, probably should subscribe to. Did a study, this was some years ago, could have been 10 or 15 years ago, where they looked at the ginseng products in the market, and they found a significant number of them had either no ginseng or only trace amounts of ginseng. So when you're looking for ginseng, I would say that what you want, first off, is a reputable company, a company that has a reputation to maintain. And these days in the herbal market, there are laws known as the GMPs, or good manufacturing processes, and the company should, all companies should now be GMP compliant. The Asian ginseng's either going to be coming out of Korea or China. And there are different types and different grades. There's white ginseng and there's red ginseng, and the red ginseng is more stimulating and more heating. What you don't want in a ginseng product is a lot of added sugar. What you don't want in a ginseng product is a product that where they don't tell you exactly what you're getting. You know, it shouldn't say just ginseng. It should say white ginseng, red ginseng. It should say where it came from, so that you know what type of quality you're getting. And, you know, the other thing that people might want to understand is that ultimately, if you are talking about self-limiting types of conditions, you just would like a little bit more energy, you're probably pretty safe getting a good quality product in the marketplace and taking it. But if you have more significant health issues, then you really want to make sure you find a practitioner who is, you know, well-trained, and they'll provide you or steer you in the right direction for, you know, good products.
So now you mentioned our American cousin, and is it true that there's more trade of American ginseng than even the Asian ginseng?
I don't know if there's more trade. American ginseng is interesting for several reasons. Number one, of course, the Chinese, back in the middle 1700s, when American ginseng was discovered by a Jesuit up in, near Montreal, they started basically collecting it and shipping it to China, and in the colonies, and then in the, you know, early United States, it was one of the major exports of the United States was ginseng. There's a record of one man who gathered something like 10,000 pounds fresh weight of ginseng in 10 years.
And was it Daniel Boone, A ginseng person?
He most certainly was. He was what's known as a sang hunter. And so ginseng, once upon a time, was not that rare a plant. Today, American ginseng is a threatened species. And so I would basically advise people who are looking to use American ginseng not to use the wild ginseng. If the product says that it's wild, don't buy it. What you want is there's wonderful products made from what is called organically woods-grown ginseng. And so this is being grown in the woods, just like its normal habitat, as opposed to under shade. And this product basically is organically grown, so there's no pesticides, no herbicides, and you can do that when you're growing it in its natural habitat, and you're not doing it intensely where it's under sort of an artificial habitat. And there's a remarkably good quality product out there. The Chinese grow a lot of American ginseng now. There's a lot of American ginseng grown in Wisconsin. There's a lot of American ginseng being grown in Canada. And now, so there's many places that you can get it, but yeah. I would really recommend avoiding the wild ginseng simply because it is a seriously threatened species.
Right. I think they call it like semi-wild. They kind of transplant it.
Yes, that's the, right. The woods-grown organic is great. And American ginseng has, in many ways, similar activity to the Asian ginseng, but it's not as stimulating. There's authorities sort of disagree as to whether it is warm in nature energetically or neutral. Some people say it's slightly cool. I would say it's pretty much neutral, and that means that it is more appropriate for somebody who is younger. You know, traditionally Asian ginseng was more reserved for people who either were elderly or really depleted and deficient, something like what we would call chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome today. Whereas American ginseng is more appropriate for people who are younger, they're not as depleted. It is used to for people with chronic dry coughs. It is also an immune amphoteric. I give it a lot to people who are exhausted, depleted, and just have no energy.
Wow. I know that's a terrible thing that you see in practice, that's for sure. Now, still in the Asian culture, there are many mushrooms and fungi that do fit the your definition in your book.
Well,
adaptogens.
There are two that really are known and have been proven to be adaptogens. One is the mushroom reishi, or lingzhir, which is Ganoderma lucidum. And this is the mushroom of immortality, or so-called, in China. And reishi is an adaptogen. It is a hard, woody polypore, so it's a shelf fungus, and you can't, like, just chew on it. In fact, I would tell them how to make this really nice soup that you can make like in the autumn and winter to help strengthen the immune system and hopefully prevent you from getting ill. And I would always tell them that what they wanted to use was in this case, not the red reishi, which is the Ganoderma lucidum, but the black reishi, which is Ganoderma sinensis. And it's a related one. It's not quite as strong. But the official one, the reishi mushroom, is really, really bitter. So I tell them to use the black reishi because it has just a nice mushroom flavor. And you cook it, but you cook it for hours at a low heat. And then you add in your other other herbs, and you add in your if you're making chicken soup, you add your chicken, all your different ingredients. And this woman came back and she said, you know, my family thought the soup tasted really good, but they were complaining that the mushrooms were just so chewy.
You're not supposed to chew them.
You're supposed to take I told them, I said, you have to strain the mushrooms out. You leave them in chunks, and you strain
them out.
It's
like biting on it. It's like biting on it, like when you cook astragalus, another herb in your book. You know, it's like biting a popsicle stick.
Yeah, a little softer than a popsicle stick. But, yeah, the reishi is basically like chewing on slightly softened wood. But, it's a wonderful mushroom, and it's also used in Chinese medicine for, as we said, it's an immune amphoteric as well. But it is also used for what's called disturption, and that means things like agitation, irritability, anxiety, bad dreams. And so it has a significant component for sort of emotional irritability as well.
And folks that can't sleep, and there's a lot of people that have these chronic fatigue issues where they sleep during the day and they're up all night. Their whole circadian rhythm is messed up.
Yeah, well, one of my beliefs is that, and there's some research showing this. I mean, everybody I treat with chronic fatigue syndrome has sleep issues. And my feeling is if you can't get them to sleep normally, and what I mean by normally is I'm not so concerned about when they're sleeping as to the fact that they're sleeping, you know, an adequate number of hours and getting good quality sleep. If you can't get their sleep quality improved dramatically, you're simply not going to get them better. I see both that and fibromyalgia as really sleep disorders. And so, yes, a mushroom like reishi might be one of the ones that you'd use in a formula for a condition like that.
The other one that you talk about that I find fascinating, especially when I'm taking my students through Chinatown and showing them these gigantic jars in the apothecaries, is Cordyceps sinensis. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Cordyceps sinensis is an interesting fungus. It's the caterpillar fungus. And what happens is you have what's called a ghost moth. And the ghost moth larva are basically parasitized by this fungus. And so you have these people in Tibet and Nepal and Bhutan who, at the foothills in the Himalayas, they literally, at the right time of year, they're walking kind of hunched over, looking for these tiny mushrooms that are about an inch tall. And when they find them, they dig them up, and then they're dried. And so this is one of the more peculiar mushrooms. Now, so it starts off, the Chinese name translates as winter insect, summer grass. Mm. And so basically what they're saying is it starts off as an insect, the larva of the moth, and then it becomes parasitized by the mushroom. And so by the time you're done, there's just a mushroom. But a lot of people, and when you see the mushrooms, when they're whole form, and they're very expensive. I mean, you're talking about $4,000 to $5,000 or more.
There's wonderful YouTube videos of, if you go on YouTube and you go to Cordyceps, you can actually see, you know, when they do that type of photography, time-lapse photography of the Cordyceps landing in a particular caterpillar. And there are other insects that turns out that they parasitize, and like an alien, virtually just like the movie Alien, whoever's seen it out there, you know, the thing just pops out of the caterpillar. It's the most amazing thing. I don't like to tell patients what they're taking when they're taking cordyceps.
Well,
they're squeamish.
The beauty is that the whole mushroom is very expensive, but you can now get cordyceps that is grown, the cordyceps mycelium, and most of the mushroom is really underground. What we see above ground, that's the fruiting body. And that's actually, think of an apple tree. The apple is not the apple tree. Well, the mushroom that we know and eat and use in medicine, in most cases, isn't really the mushroom. Most of the mushroom, the mycelium, is underground.
Right.
And so now they grow the mycelium on soybeans, and it's way less expensive, and it's quite active. So you can get really good cordyceps products made from the mycelial extracts, and you don't have to worry. There's no insect involved at all, and it's just a mushroom.
Very
so for people who are squeamish, that's the way to go. And plus, for people who don't want to spend ridiculous amounts of money for the actual mushroom, it works really well. But cordyceps is amazing because cordyceps is used for both male and female infertility. It is used for what's called deficient kidney yin and yang, and that includes a whole range of endocrine dysfunction as well as degenerative kidney disease. And it's one of my most important herbs for people with things like chronic nephritis with degeneration or glomerulonephritis. And I use it with another herb called nettle seed, which is incredibly useful for kidney disease. We also use cordyceps for people with autoimmune diseases, especially autoimmune diseases of the kidney. It is a remarkable mushroom, and it has a million uses. And one of the things that's interesting is there's actual studies showing that, you know, because a lot of people were concerned that if you gave this mushroom, for instance, with somebody who had had an organ transplant, that it would cause the person to reject the organ. And in this case, there's actually a study showing that it was given concurrently with medication to prevent, like cyclosporin, to prevent organ transplant rejection. And it not only didn't interfere with the medication, it actually enhanced the function of the new kidney.
Right. And that's critical.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break and get some herb tea. And I know that they want to do some type of station ID. When we return, we'll talk more about adaptogens with David Winston and his book, Adaptogens, Herb for Strength, Stamina, and Stress Relief. Don't touch that dial.
Progressive Radio Network, now on your iPod or smartphone. Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and click on your device to hear us anytime and anywhere. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, your home for news and information.
PRN is your number one stop for progressive health, fitness, and food. Featuring Prescriptions for Health with Len and Vicky Saputo.
A few things on growing older now. You know you're getting old when everything either dries up or leaks.
Oh, dear.
Being young is beautiful, but being old is comfortable.
That's for sure.
Well, if you don't have aches and pains.
That's pretty neat that you cheer us up, Vicky. We're talking about so many serious things that sometimes you can get a downer.
It's all about food with Karen Hartglass.
We've got all this industrial agriculture going on, and I love progress and I love technology, but sometimes things get a little out of hand, and that's true when it comes to the factory farming of animals. Bad news, horrific, cruel, environmentally damaging. People are eating a lot more today, and what's happening? Our health is in the toilet.
Fitness Express with Anthony DeMarco.
Our goal is to share the best practices of the world's best progressive fitness minds, create a forum where people can create fitness goals and get questions answered and change the way people think about fitness.
And The Natural Nurse with Ellen Cammy and Dr. Z.
One of the many topics that would be an excellent thing to focus on for yourself and your family right now is the use of herbal medicine. Make sure that you have knowledge at your fingertips to take care of yourself and your family with natural remedies, including herbs.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello there. This is Mitchell Rabin of A Better World Radio. I interview the sung and the unsung heroes of our society. You can listen to me live every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or download the show anytime from the archives at prn.fm. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward. We hope you're coming with us.
This is the Progressive Radio Network. Information for the independent mind.
And welcome back, and we'll get right into our conversation because we don't want to waste a minute, precious minute, while we have David Winston on the line, author of Adaptogens, Herb for Strength, Stamina, and Stress Relief. David, welcome back, and tell us a little bit about this very interesting berry that has kind of made it into the multi-level marketing type of thing. Not to say anything against that, but nonetheless, this would be known as the wolfberry.
Well, yes, the Chinese name is gochitze, and since they figured Americans couldn't pronounce that, they shortened it to goji berry. And yes, this is being promoted very, very widely. There are goji berry products, goji berry juice, and the reality is this is an herb that's been traditionally used in Chinese medicine for, again, thousands of years. It's a fruit. It's in the nightshade family. So, for instance, people who have nightshade sensitivities, which are pretty rare but occasionally do occur, should probably avoid goji berry because it has those same Solanaceae-type alkaloids. But for most people, it's a very healthy fruit. It is really rich in carotenoids, including things like lycopene, which has been shown to have protective effects against things like cancer, and it also contains lutein, which has protective and strengthening effects on the eyes. It also contains flavonoids, which are antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. So we are talking about something that has traditionally been used in Chinese medicine for a very long time, and it was used as a tonic remedy, especially for the eyes. And so in Chinese medicine, this is one of the sort of what would be considered liver remedies. And the reason for that is in Chinese medicine, each organ opens to one of the sensory organs. And so the Chinese liver, which we would not want to confuse with the Western organ called the liver because they're very different, opens to the eyes. So many of the liver remedies in Chinese medicine are eye remedies. And so this has been traditionally used to strengthen the eyesight, to help prevent night blindness, to help prevent things like diabetic retinopathy or age-related macular degeneration, which is the most common cause of blindness.
How about dry and blurry eyes? I've had a number of people, as they're hitting 50, 55, they're coming in, they're saying, you know what, I can't see like I used to.
Yeah, well, you know, I have a friend, his name is Russell, and Russell used to have this thing, and he came up with this when he was in his 20s, I think. He said, you know, when you're a teenager, you're a superhero. No, I'm sorry, when you're a teenager, you're immortal. In your 20s, you become a superhero. In your 30s, you become mortal, and at 40, the warranty wears off. And what he didn't know is the fun of 50s and later. And the reality is that, you know, the eyes are kind of the first thing. And so, yes, this is not going to give you the eyesight that you had when you're in your 20s, but
right.
It can slow the progression of a lot of age-related conditions associated with the eye.
Right.
And what happens is all those carotenoids and flavonoids help to strengthen, nourish, and protect all those small capillaries in the eyes so that they are really useful for helping with those sorts of things. And so I would say while they won't prevent you, you know, if you have a cataract or you have glaucoma, it's not going to treat those conditions. Using them on a regular basis may help prevent them or slow the progression of those conditions for somebody who already has it. Interestingly enough, when we look at goji berry, though, there are also other uses. And this is an herb. When we look at adaptogens, there are about a dozen plants that we absolutely know are adaptogens. And then we have about another dozen that there's evidence that they may be adaptogens, but we're not 100% sure. And lycium fruit or goji berry fits into that category. It may be an adaptogen, but we're not 100% sure. But what we do know is it also helps protect the liver against damage from chemicals such as acetaminophen or other potentially hepatotoxic pharmaceuticals. It can help protect the liver against damage from viruses. And yes, if somebody has hepatitis B or C, it's not going to cure them, but it can help strengthen and protect against some of the damage associated with those conditions.
And the white blood cells, if you're undergoing chemo or radiation therapy.
Absolutely. And studies have shown that taking lycium fruit, and I would do it probably as an extract rather than just eating the fruit, but you could eat the fruit, certainly helps protect against decreased white blood cell counts while people are undergoing chemotherapy and radiation. It also helps protect against decreased red blood cell counts. So, yes, it has protective effects there as well, and it's been shown to help protect against altitude sickness, although usually you combine it with other herbs, including one of the ones you always combine it with is cordyceps, which
right.
we just talked about. And it also enhances peripheral circulation. So for people who have impaired circulation to the hands or feet, and again, we go back to something like diabetes. We talked about diabetic retinopathy, which is the degeneration of eyes that takes place with people with diabetes. Well, they also tend to get a condition called diabetic neuropathy, which is a painful, burning sensation in the feet, especially starts in the heels.
Right.
And it can also help protect against that.
Fascinating. And it's a fruit.
It's a fruit.
You eat it like a raisin. I know you have. I use, like, usually the last few minutes when I'm steaming rice or making
mm-hmm.
quinoa, I'll throw the goji berries in and just kind of steam them up.
Absolutely. You can cook, you know, what's one of the beauties of in Chinese medicine is, I mean, some things you're not going to cook with. Some things are just too bitter or whatever and you're not going to make as a food. But there are many herbs that can be used in cooking that are not only something you add just because, you know, it's good for you, but you can add it because it actually tastes great. So not just the things you're used to cooking with, like garlic and ginger and cinnamon and, you know, all your various, spice herbs and things like that, but things like astragalus in lamb stew or
Whoa.
the black reishi in making black reishi chicken soup. Or in my adaptogens book, I have a recipe for a goji berry rice pilaf.
Right, and sticky rice, danshen sweet rice. So
yeah,
what's nice about your book is you also give readers practical ways to make these soups and cordials and broths and congees and teas and wine even, Hoshuwu wine.
Yeah.
That's one thing we should talk about. We can't leave China. We just can't move on to India yet.
We'll get there.
Let's talk about one more Chinese plant, the Hoshuwu, because it's got such a fascinating folklore behind it.
It does. Hoshuwu supposedly means old Mr. Ha. And the story goes is he was a general in the Chinese army. This is thousands of years ago. His troops mutinied, and they didn't want to kill him, so they threw him in a cave and walled up the cave so he was going to starve to death.
Right.
And they come back, I don't know, 6 months later, and they figure they'll take out, you know, they'll open the cave back up, they'll bring his bones back to his family so that they can bury him properly and everything. I mean, they're being real nice for somebody they basically tried to murder. And they open up the cave, and old Mr. He walks out, and when he went in, and they put him in the cave, he was bald, and his hair, you know, what hair he had left, it all turned, you know, white, and he comes out of the cave, and he's regrown his hair is black, and he's healthy.
Wow.
And he supposedly, while he's in the cave, he lived on the roots of the Hoshuwu, which were growing through the top of the cave, supposedly. And, you know, that these type of apocryphal stories, probably not. But and there was a spring in the cave, so he lived on those two things. And so it has a tradition of being used for hair loss, although it's not as much for hair loss, but for helping to turn prematurely graying hair to make it turn black again. It's also believed to strengthen the muscles, sinews, ligaments. It's used a lot in Chinese medicine as an herb to help protect the liver. It's used to strengthen the blood. So it has a whole range of uses in Chinese medicine, and it's even been found to protect against, in animal studies, not in human studies, but in animal studies, to help protect against age-related degeneration of the brain.
And you said in the book that it's good for, you know, I'm pretty close to getting my black belt now, my son. And boy, I take some serious hits. And you say it's used for hip medicine.
Yeah, well, hip medicine is the English translation of the Chinese term, basically martial arts medicine.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that I always found interesting, and when I was younger, I trained in Lung Yung Pai, Southern Kung Fu, Praying Mantis Kung Fu. And one of the things I always found interesting is when you'd work with Chinese sifus, they would be 80 years old, and they could still throw you across the room, and they didn't have any arthritis. They were in great health. And when you'd meet somebody who was often, like, trained in martial arts in the military or something like that, you know, they had all sorts of arthritic joints, and they had all sorts of pain and all sorts of problems from practicing martial arts for so many years. And one of the things that one of my elders once told me is he said that the reason was is that in Chinese medicine, people who are coming from Chinese medicine and practicing martial arts are also doing internal martial arts. So they're doing not only the external forms, they're doing the internal forms like Qigong and Tai Chi and things like that, and they're using these hit medicines. So when you get a hematoma, when you get a bruise, when you get a sprain or strain, they're using all these external medicines called ditats, and they're using them topically to help heal the tissue, not only the muscle and to get rid of the stagnant blood, but they're also using it to treat the underlying energy. So they're using it to clear the meridians so that the energy can flow. And, of course, in the West, they don't recognize that those things exist. But in China, they most certainly do. And the reality is, or the proof that's in the pudding, is when you see these old Chinese masters, they're in great health.
Wow.
And they've taken just as many hits, and they've taken, you know, they've sat there and pounded their hand on a concrete post just as many times, and they use what are called iron palm liniments and iron vest liniments and things like that, and they do it both preventatively and to treat trauma and wounds.
They're amazing, I got to say. There's a great book, The Tooth from the Tiger's Mouth. You've heard of that book? Yeah,
absolutely.
It gives you nice recipes on how to make those. But that's another story.
So you know,
we've got
to
move to India because we're running out of time, and I do want to talk a little bit about ashwagandha, of course.
Ashwagandha, or in India, ashwagandha. Ashwagandha is with Vannia somniferum. It is it's an herb that I've been using for probably about 25 years. And when I first learned about it, I was scared of it because it's a nightshade. And, you know, think of how many nightshades do you use the root?
Right.
And the answer is not many.
Not too many.
But this one is perfectly safe. And
wow.
There are a significant number of clinical studies showing ashwagandha is a very effective adaptogen. It's traditionally used in China, in Ayurvedic medicine, especially for men, although it's not only used for men, but it's used to enhance libido. It's used to enhance sperm count, sperm motility. So it's used for male infertility. And there's studies very clearly, human studies, not animal studies, human studies showing that it indeed works. It also stimulates thyroid function, so we use it for people who are hypothyroid. It also enhances, is one of the richest herbs in iron. So for people with iron deficiency anemia, it's cooked in milk and you put in some molasses and it's taken in that form. It's used by women in Ayurvedic medicine and in India as a tonic during pregnancy. It's that safe.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting because it's not a teratogen at all or anything like that.
No, absolutely.
Not many herbs are in that category. That's fascinating.
Well, the adaptogens that can be used like ashwagandha, the answer is not very many. It's a rather remarkable plant, to say the least.
And tell us a little bit about shilajit, which is not really an herb. It's really a bituminous mud.
Bituminous asphaltum, shilajit,
right.
Or shilajitu, and there's a second form coming out of the Caucasus Mountains in Russia called Mume, or Mumeyo. And it is basically this exudate that comes out of the rocks on hot days. It exudes from rocks. And,
wow.
And the belief is that it actually comes from humus. So actually, it's a combination between decayed herbs and soil.
Wow.
And this is a really interesting substance, and it's good shilajit is very expensive, and it's not something, this is something that unlike most adaptogens where I would say people are pretty safe using most of them, shilajit, you want to make sure that it's a good quality shilajit. It's supposed to have been processed, washed numerous times and everything to get rid of impurities and things like that. But I have to tell you that I have a friend who's a phenomenal Ayurvedic herbalist, and as a wedding present several years ago, he gave me a little silk bag filled with the finest quality shilajitu pills. And, you know, I looked at it, and he goes, you need to understand, what you have in your hand costs a fortune.
Wow.
And this person is a type 1 diabetic. And among other things, I mean, he's very careful with his diet, and he uses insulin and everything else. But one of the things, he is in his early 50s, and he's in incredible health. And one of the things he attributes that to is using shilajit.
Is these powerful adaptogens.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, towards the tail end of the program, we've got a few minutes left. How do you kind of use these things? I know it sounds like you really need to match the person to the adaptogen, and it may be best to seek out a practitioner.
Well, there are several ways to do this, and I'm glad you asked that because it's true. A lot of people, you know, have these ideas that herbs are natural, so they're all safe. Mm-hmm. And while most herbs are actually incredibly safe, more so than over-the-counter medicines, the reality is there are herbs that are toxic. We certainly don't want people just indiscriminately using these things. We want people to educate themselves. So if you're talking about adaptogens, obviously getting a copy of the book and reading it will give you lots of information as to where it's appropriate and the appropriate dose and things like that. For people who have more complicated cases, whether they seek out a clinical herbalist or a naturopathic physician or an MD or nurse practitioner who are knowledgeable about herbs, that is also really useful. And I would just make mention that for people who are interested in really learning more about this and are thinking of this is something they'd like to do as a profession or add to what they already do, I have a 2-year herb studies program, and it'll be starting up again in September, the new semester. And it is one of the most comprehensive herb studies programs in the United States.
And it's part online, right? And part,
well,
you kind of go to school? Or
It's both live online and live in school. So if somebody's within commuting distance, and we're in northwestern New Jersey, they can come and sit in the class. And for people who are further away, we have students all over the United States, Canada, England, Ireland, Iceland. For people who are far away, they can be there live online, and they can ask questions and have their for all our information and free downloads of articles and books and things like that is herbaltherapeutics.net.
Herbaltherapeutics.net.
Correct, and herbalstudies.net.
Great. Oh, Dave, boy, that was a great synopsis of adaptogens, and you know we need these adaptogens for their powerful effect of restoring and protecting our health and staying young, and there's real evidence to show that that's true. Leave us with some hope that these herbs can really maybe not slow down us what's on our driver's license, but make us look a lot younger and feel better.
Not just look younger, but feel younger and be healthier. And I think the real key is, you know, most Americans want to live to be 85 or 90, but they want to be 85 or 90 and be 35. Because, you know, as everybody says, getting old is not so much fun. Well, let's make it so that getting old is not so difficult, that we can be old and we can be elderly and healthy and live life to its fullest to the extent that we are going to be here.
Fabulous. Thank you, David. And
Thank you.
That was David Winston, author of Adaptogens, Herbs for Strength, Stamina, and Stress Relief. And thank you very much for joining us on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We'll see you in a couple weeks. Stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.